I was going to rise above it all, even if that included my father, the one stable family member I had. After paying for one summer at that performing arts camp, the most my father ever did for my career was to warn me about how uncertain and treacherous the entertainment business could be. Years later, I called my father and played Vision of Love from the recording studio, putting the phone receiver right up to the Yamaha speaker. "Wow," he said, "you sound like all three Pointer Sisters." He wasn't a big music man, so this comparison was high praise coming from him. It meant he had noticed all the layers of the background vocals in addition to the strong lead. He was really listening to my song, and I could tell he was happy with it and with me. After all those years, it was truly validating. Yet, even after all I had accomplished, I wasn't immune to the perfectionism he had projected onto his other children. After I had garnered 2 Grammys within my very first year in the industry, he remarked, "Maybe if you were a producer, you could win more, like Quincy Jones." That same year, the legendary Quincy Jones took home 7 Grammys for his epic project, Back on the Block, which spanned the entire history of Black American music and featured giants from Ella Fitzgerald and Miles Davis to Luther Vandross. I had done astonishingly well as a new artist who had written her own hit songs, and here my father was comparing me to arguably one of the greatest musical giants the industry has ever known, with decades of experience and endless accolades and honors to his name. I was immediately thrust back to my childhood, as if my 2 Grammys were 2 A's on my report card, and he was asking me what had happened to the pluses. I think my success in music scared him because he had no idea about and seemingly no influence on how I'd arrived. He didn't ask and I didn't tell. Gradually, next Sunday turned into a month of Sundays. I had to let go of our Sundays so I could manifest my own day in the sun. Coloring outside the lines.
It's hard to explain. Inherently, it's just always been strange. Neither here nor there. Always somewhat out of place everywhere. Ambiguous without a sense of belonging to touch.
Outside. My first encounters with racism were like a first kiss in reverse. Each time, a piece of purity was ripped from my being. Left behind was a spreading stain, which seeped so deeply inside of me that to this day, I've never been able to completely scrub it out. Not with time, not with fame or wealth, not even with love. The earliest of these encounters happened when I was about 4 years old and in preschool. The activity for the day was to draw a portrait of our families. Laid out on the table was a stack of heavy stock construction paper the color of eggshells and small groups of crayons for us to pick from. While I much preferred sing-along and story time to coloring, I was excited about the project and determined to do my very best. I thought if I did a good job, maybe the teacher would decorate my drawing with a gold foil star sticker. I chose my supplies carefully, found a quiet corner, and got busy with the assignment. At that point, our family of 5 had not yet fractured. For a short time, I had a father, a mother, a sister, and a brother, and we were all living together in what felt to me like relative peace. I wanted to create a family portrait I could be proud of. I wanted to draw all the different unique things about everybody, their clothes, their heights and proportions, their facial features, all the little details that would make my portrait come to life. Father was tall and mother had long dark hair. My brother was strong and my sister had her pretty ringlets. I wanted to capture all of it. The sound of crayons rubbing on thick paper created a dull hum as the faint, comforting scent of Crayola wax wafted through the room. Deeply engaged with perfecting my masterpiece, I was curled over with my head down, nose nearly touching the paper, when I felt a tall shadow fall across my quiet corner. I knew instinctively that it was one of the young student teachers looming over me. At 4 years old, I had already begun to develop a keen watch-your-back instinct, so I immediately stopped moving my hand. Tension rose up and stiffened my little body. For a reason I did not yet know, I sensed danger and felt suddenly protective. I held absolutely still until she spoke. "How you doing there, Mariah? Let's see." Relaxing a bit, I lifted the paper toward her and proudly presented my family picture in progress. Immediately, the student teacher burst into laughter. She was soon joined by another young woman teacher, who also began to laugh. Then a third adult came over to join in the fun. The cheerful buzz of children working with crayons stopped. The whole room had turned to stare at what was happening in my little corner. A brew of self-consciousness and embarrassment boiled up from my feet to my face. The whole class was watching. I managed to speak through the stifling heat in my throat. "Why are you laughing?" I asked. Through her giggles, one of them replied, "Oh, Mariah, you used the wrong crayon. You didn't mean to do that." She was pointing at where I'd drawn my father. As they kept laughing, I looked down at the picture of my family I had lovingly and diligently been creating. I'd used the peach crayon for the skin of myself, my mother, my sister, and my brother. I'd used a brown crayon for my father. I knew I was more like the color of animal crackers and my brother and sister were more like Nutter Butters, while my father's skin tone resembled graham crackers. But they didn't have any cookie-colored crayons, so I'd had to improvise. They were acting like I'd used a green crayon or something. I was humiliated and confused. What had I done so wrong? Still cackling hysterically, the teachers insisted, "You used the wrong crayon." Every time one of them made the declaration, the whole gang laughed, laughed, and laughed some more. A debilitating kind of disgrace was pressing down on me, yet I managed to pull myself up slowly, eyes burning and brimming with hot tears. As calmly as I could, I told the teachers, "No, I didn't use the wrong crayon." Refusing to even give me the dignity of addressing me directly, one of them said to the other, snidely, "She doesn't even know she's using the wrong crayon." The laughter and taunting seemed like it would never end. I stood glaring up at them, working very hard not to vomit from embarrassment. But despite my nausea, I did not break my glare. Eventually, the laughter started to subside, and one at a time, they backed away from the picture and from me. I watched them across the room, huddled together and whispering. They had only ever seen one member of my family of five, my mother, who dropped me off at school each day. She was the color of the peach crayon. They had no idea and no imagination to suspect that the light toast of my skin, my bigger-than-button nose, and the waves and ringlets in my hair were from my father, my handsome father, who was the color of warm maple syrup. His complexion was a crayon color they didn't have. Brown was as close to right as I could get. It was the teachers who had got it all wrong. But despite their cruel and unwarranted attack, they never apologized for the public humiliation, for their ignorance and immaturity, or for demoralizing a four-year-old girl during coloring time. By the time I made it to first grade, my family of five had crumbled like cookies. My parents divorced, but although they were living a short car ride away from each other, racially, their neighborhoods on Long Island were worlds apart. In first grade, I had a best friend named Becky. She was cute and sweet and looked just like the Strawberry Shortcake cartoon to me. She had big blue eyes, smooth strawberry blonde hair that was naturally sun-kissed and hung perfectly straight down like heavy drapes, and reddish freckles sprinkled across her whipped cream-colored cheeks. In my mind, she looked like what little girls were supposed to look like. She looked like the little girls who were adored and protected, like the little girl my mother might have had with a man her mother would have approved of. One Sunday, our mothers made arrangements for Becky and me to have a playdate at my house. I was delighted because Becky and I really had fun together. When Sunday finally arrived, my mother picked up Becky in whatever ragtag car she was driving at the time, and we headed to my father's house. We pulled up to the brick townhouse, and Becky and I hopped out of the car. I grabbed her hand and skipped excitedly up the steps. Curiously, my mother hung back and watched. Ordinarily, she would have driven off. Just as our feet hit the top of the stoop, my 6'2" tall, dashing father emerged through the door with a hearty grin. He looked like a movie star. "Hiya, Mariah," he called out, giving me my usual greeting. As he neared us, Becky suddenly released my hand. Her body froze stiff, and like a bursting rain cloud, she exploded into tears. Confused, I looked to my father for help, but I could see that he was frozen too, and breathless, a mortified look twisting his strong features. In a state of shock, my mind scrambled as I tried to process the abrupt and painful turn of events. Becky in hysterics, my father in silent agony. How had we gotten here in a single instant? I didn't know what to do. I was stuck there, unmoving, for what felt like hours, but was likely merely moments. Finally, my mother came up behind us on the stairs to Becky's rescue. Without even a glance in my direction, she gently placed her arm around the distraught little girl and wordlessly guided her down the stairs and into the back seat of her car. My mother sped off with the strawberry blonde, without ever making any attempt to clarify what had happened. There was no consolation, no mediation, no acknowledgement of the devastation to me or my father. In the wake of Becky's storm, my father and I stood quietly together on the stoop and waited for the ache to pass. Nobody ever mentioned it after that, but we never played together again, and the moment remained with me forever. And believe it or not, her name really was Becky. No one ever outwardly questioned my ethnic background when I was alone with my mother. They didn't dare ask about or else could not detect the differences in our hues and textures. Becky, and most likely her mother too, had probably just assumed my father was also white or maybe something exotic, but certainly not black. That day on the stoop, I learned beyond the shadow of a doubt that I was not like the people I went to school with or who lived in my neighborhood. My father was totally different from them, and they were afraid of him. But he was my people. I came from him. That day, I saw firsthand how their fear hurt him, and his hurt deeply hurt me too. But what was perhaps most painful that afternoon was that he saw that I saw their fear of him. He knew it would impact me forever. He knew I could never return to the innocence all children deserve. Huddle. Singing was a form of escapism for me, and writing was a form of processing. There was joy in it, but mainly it was survival, and it still is. My voice was recognized as pure talent not only by my mother, but also by one of my teachers. A friend of my mother's was my music teacher, and she was exceptional. As a child, I was in a few school plays, and I would sing for friends at random events. Singing on stage or anywhere, imagining I was someone else, was when I felt most like myself. Walking around alone and coming up with melodies while singing to myself was when I felt the most whole. To this day, I escape to my private vocal booth to shut out all the demands of life and feel myself in my space, singing alone. I was in the fifth grade when I first got the opportunity to attend an exclusive performing arts summer camp. This was a breakthrough. I could finally be around other young aspiring artists and hone my craft, undistracted by the confusion and chaos at home. I landed the role of Huddle, one of the five daughters in the camp's production of Fiddler on the Roof. I lived to go to rehearsals. It was my favorite time and place. I was confident, quickly learning the songs and studying their meanings. The act of practicing came naturally to me. I like doing things over and over again. I love the experience of witnessing my performance getting better with each try, finding new and better ways to deliver a song. The drive to practice music was also something my mother recognized and encouraged in me early on. She rehearsed the Fiddler songs with me at home, playing along on her Yamaha piano. Even as a little girl, I was interested in exploring the details that made up a great song, and I was fascinated by the storytelling in the musical. I even managed to make a camp friend in the community of largely Jewish and mostly wealthy kids. We bonded through our love and seriousness of singing. We even kind of looked alike. She was Israeli with thick, curly, almost kinky hair. So we both had tangled textures. We tried to dress alike when we could. We had the same pink onesie. Because people saw us together, saw some physical similarities, I think they thought I was a blondish Jewish girl from Means. I loved Huddle because she fell in love with a revolutionary boy and went to the ends of the earth to follow her passion. My big number was in the second act, a song called Far From the Home I Love. It was a well-suited song for my breathy tone, and I remember I sang it in a purely emotional way. The song opened with these lovely, memorable lines.
How can I hope to make you understand why I do what I do? Why I must travel to a distant land, far from the home I love.
My father was coming up to the camp for the show's opening night, and I was thrilled. He was a practical man who wasn't thrilled with my artistic passion, but he had reluctantly paid half of my hefty tuition for the camp that year. So while he was certainly coming to support me, he was also checking in on his investment. I didn't have the privilege of trying all different kinds of hobbies like the kids I went to school with. It was this camp or bust. So I knew I had to get all I could from it. There was no flitting from tennis lessons to guitar to dance class. Not that I would ever step foot in a dance class, even if we could afford it. I was traumatized early on about dancing. One time, when Addie was at my father's house, she looked at me with my unruly flaxen hair and peach crayon-colored skin and said, "Roy, that ain't your baby." Then, as if to prove her point, she addressed me, "Girl, let me see you dance." While I was surrounded by music, there wasn't much dancing in my childhood. My mother didn't dance. I never saw my siblings dance. My father didn't dance until later in the 80s when he took hustle lessons. In my mind, dancing became a measurement for Black acceptance, for belonging somewhere and to someone, for belonging to my father. I didn't dance for Addie that day. I didn't dance much at all after that. I just couldn't recover from the fear of not dancing right for my father. I stood there terrified to move, fearing if I didn't dance well enough or if I moved the wrong way, it would somehow prove that my father wasn't my father. That day at camp, as Huddle, I sang and smiled and pranced about the stage and sang some more. I sang in a very distinct lullaby style. I was good, and everybody knew it. I could hear the loud clapping as I took my bow. It was like another kind of grand music, giving me energy, giving me hope. As I raised my head, I saw the widest smile on my father's face. His smile was like sunshine itself. He walked up to the edge of the stage, his arms filled with a big bouquet of sunny daisies tied with a lavender ribbon. Beaming with pride, he handed me the flowers as if they were a prestigious award. At first, we were both too giddy to notice that people were staring at us, and not in a way that felt good. Not because I had given the outstanding performance of the night. They were staring because my father was the only Black man in sight, and I belonged to him. That night, the teachers, the parents, and all the other campers learned that my father was a Black man, and I paid the price for it. I got my thunderous applause, and I got my flowers, but I never got another major role in a play at that camp again.
Please be at peace, Father. I'm at peace with you. Bitterness isn't worth clinging to. After all the anguish we've all been through.
Sunflowers for Alfred Roy. Light of my life.
Letting go ain't easy. Ooh. Oh, it's just exceedingly hurtful. 'Cause somebody you used to know.
No.
Is flinging your world around and they watch as you're falling
down, 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 down,
falling down, baby.
The art of letting go. You've always been the light of my life. My mother told me this over and over when I was a child. I wanted to be her light. I wanted to make her proud. I respected her as a singer and a working mother. I loved her deeply. And, like most kids, I wanted her to be a safe place for me. Above all, I desperately wanted to believe her. But ours is a story of betrayal and beauty, of love and abandonment, of sacrifice and survival. I've emancipated myself from bondage several times, but there is a cloud of sadness that I suspect will always hang over me, not simply because of my mother, but because of our complicated journey together. It has caused me so much pain and confusion. Time has shown me there is no benefit trying to protect people who never tried to protect me. Time and motherhood have finally given me the courage to honestly face who my mother has been to me. For me, this is the steepest cliff edge. If I can make it to the other side of this truth, I know there is relief of epic proportions awaiting me. Those people who have hurt me over and over, whom I've escaped or walled off, are deeply significant in my story, but they are not central to my existence. Removing myself from toxic people I love has been excruciatingly painful, but once I found the courage, with prayer and professional help, of course, I simply let go and let God. I'll add, though, there's a huge difference between simple and easy. It ain't easy, baby. Yet, there is no artful way of letting go of my mother, and our relationship is anything but simple. Like many aspects of my life, my journey with my mother has been full of contradictions and competing realities. It's never been only black and white. It's been a whole rainbow of emotions. Our relationship is a prickly rope of pride, pain, shame, gratitude, jealousy, admiration, and disappointment. A complicated love tethers my heart to my mother's. When I became a mother to rock and roll, my heart grew two times over as my capacity for pure love expanded, the ability to tow heavy pain from my past diminished. Healthy, powerful love did that for me. It illuminated the dark spots and unearthed buried hurt. The new, clear light that emanates from my children's love now rushes through every artery, every cell, every dark nook and cranny of my being. Even after all this time, a part of me fantasizes that one of these days, my mother will transform into one of those caring mothers I saw on TV as a child, like Carol Brady or Claire Huxtable. That she will suddenly ask me, "Honey, how was your day?" before she gives me a report on her dog or her bird, or asks me to pay for something or do something, that she will have genuine, sustained interest in me and what I'm doing or feeling, that one day she will know me, that one day my mother will understand me. To a certain extent, I know how my mother became who she is. Her mother certainly didn't understand her, and her father never had a chance to know her. He died while her mother was pregnant with her. She was one of three children raised by a widowed Irish Catholic woman. My mother was known as the Dark One because her hair wasn't blonde and her eyes were a mix of brown and green, not pure blue like her brothers and sisters. Blue eyes were a symbol of the purity of whiteness, and being of 100% pure Irish descent was central to her mother's entire identity. My mother grew up in the 1940s and 1950s in Springfield, Illinois. It was the capital city at the center of a state at the center of the country. But Springfield was also a center of insidious institutional racism. In 1908, a white woman was allegedly raped by a black man, the same accusation leveled against my father and countless other innocent black men, which ignited a three-day riot by white citizens in which two black men were lynched and four white men were shot to death by black businessmen protecting their property. In the 1920s, when my mother's mother was coming of age, the Ku Klux Klan had a strong presence in the city and the city government, holding several key positions and setting the moral compass for the community. Springfield was a city openly cloaked in hate. One of the few stories my mother told of her childhood was of being in kindergarten and sharing her mat with a black boy at nap time. For this, the nuns at her Catholic school publicly shamed her. Obviously, there was a rancid repertoire of slurs for black people in my mother's youth, but she also told me of the odd slurs and degrading names they had for Italians, Jewish people, and all others when no one else was around. She made me privy to the hierarchy of racism in their white community. Ironically, even among her beloved Irish, there was a social caste system that divided the, quote, lace curtain Irish from the, quote, shanty Irish. The lace curtain Irish were pure, well-off, respectable, and properly placed in society. Think of the Kennedys. While the shanty Irish were characterized as dirty, poor, and ignorant. There was a critical and pitiful need in this system to have a host of others to look down on. To my mother's mother, all others were below the Irish, but black? Black people were always at the absolute bottom of the order. Nothing was below black. My mother not only ignored the moral code of her hometown, she rebelled against it, later becoming active in the civil rights movement. By the standards of her environment and family, she was a liberal eccentric. She was interested in life outside their tiny, tight, white world. She was intellectually curious and drawn to culture, especially to classical music. She recalls that one day, while listening to a classical music station on the radio, she heard an aria. It was the most beautiful sound she'd ever heard, and she was determined to chase it, inside herself and out in the world. She decided to start her quest in New York City, which seemed a million miles away from her family and the small-minded place they inhabited. Young Patricia had big dreams, many of which she realized. She was extremely gifted and driven. Winning a scholarship to the prestigious Juilliard School for Music, she would go on to sing with the New York City Opera, making her debut at Lincoln Center. My mother built an exciting, artsy, bohemian life in New York City. She was in the downtown scene and dated a diverse cast of men by whom her mother would have been mortified. Her pure Irish Catholic mother wouldn't approve of her dating anyone who wasn't Lily White. Of course, in turn, the white supremacists of Illinois weren't crazy about the Irish or Catholics. The WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, as they were referred to at that time, always needed a fresh supply of people to have beneath them. An Italian guy would have been a problem. A Jewish man, a tragedy. My grandmother would have come completely undone if she knew my mother had had a steamy affair with a rich, older Lebanese man named Francois right before she fell in love with and married a man her mother could not even conceive of, my father, a beautiful, complicated black man. This, to my grandmother and her community, was the worst thing her daughter could do to her and to the family lineage. Talking to a black man was considered a shame, befriending one, an outrage, carrying on with one, a major scandal, but marrying one? That was an abomination. It was the ultimate humiliation. My mother's marriage to my father was beyond betrayal to her mother. It was a high crime against her white heritage, punishable by excommunication. To her mother, who grew up in a time and place where the KKK openly held mass rallies and were active in government, marrying a black man carried a burden of shame she could not fathom. Her mother was raised not to drink from the same fountain as black people, not to sit in the same seat as black people, or swim in the same pool. She was taught and believed that black people were dirty and that blackness could rub off. After all, the United States is the birthplace of the one-drop rule. The racial classification system that asserts that any person with an ancestor possessing even one drop of black blood is considered black. In my grandmother's view, my mother loving my father made her a bottom feeder, procreating with the lowest human group and making mulatto mongrels, me and my siblings. Needless to say, my grandmother completely disowned her daughter. She told no one else in the family her daughter was married to a black man and pregnant with a son. Save for a few sporadic, secret phone calls, my mother became almost entirely disconnected from her mother. She wouldn't go back to her hometown for many years to come. Even the most gifted, compassionate, progressive person cannot easily overcome being completely rejected by their mother. To have the love of a mother is too primal a need. Whatever soft place my mother might have had to land was hardened like concrete by her own mother's ignorant, fearful family and upbringing. Even her marriage to my father and the births of three beautiful children couldn't fully heal the deep wound of maternal rejection. Nothing can. I also doubt loving a black man and having mixed children is the cure-all for generations of belief steeped in white superiority, and my mother and her family were steeped down to the white of their bones. I've often wondered why my mother defied her mother, family, and heritage by marrying my father. What was her full motivation? Was it all in the name of unconditional love? It was never "we belong together" between them. She never reminisced to me about their romance, nor was there any physical evidence of it. No photos, no poems, no letters, no trace of a great love. Well, there were three children. Maybe my mother wanted to keep her history and memories of my father private, though I can't help but wonder if her marriage wasn't in part a rebellion against her mother. Did she do it for the attention, the drama of it all? More than once over the decades, I've heard my mother order her coffee black like my men. She's often done it in front of me and one of her young black grandsons. Awkward. To be honest, I don't know if my mother ever wanted to get married and have children so young. I could understand her wanting to create a safety net, a new family of her own, and to continue blazing trails, leaving her backward home and family behind. But what I couldn't understand was her abandoning her promising singing career to do so. From very early on, I decided that I didn't want the same fate. I couldn't have a man or an unplanned pregnancy take me off my path. Witnessing my mother's and my sister's detours was a sad and stinging warning. Watching their dreams go up in flames burned a cautionary tale into my mind. In 1977, my mother recorded an album she titled To Start Again. But by that time, she'd already had a troubled interracial marriage, 3 kids, a divorce, and 1 child still living with her, me. Did she think a record company would suddenly discover her? This is one of many miscalculations that as a child I observed my mother make and placed in a file labeled What Not to Do. Time rolled by after my parents' divorce, and eventually my grandmother allowed my mother to visit her with her granddaughter, but only her youngest granddaughter. I was a 12-year-old little girl and didn't quite understand why she only invited me. Looking back, I suspect it was because I was blondish and very fair for a mixed kid. I didn't raise much suspicion to the culturally untrained eye. I was too young to know how my mother and her mother interacted with each other, and I never knew what happened between them at that point. Was there an apology from Pat's mother for disowning her daughter and withholding family from her? Did she reckon with her racism? Was there forgiveness? I don't know. What I do remember is that she was stiff and formal. She had stark white hair that she wore neatly away from her face with 1 big wave in the front. On her stern face, she wore black cat-eyed glasses. Her house was not warm, and there was no smell to the place. I recall her coming into the quiet, sterile bedroom where I slept while I was there after my mother had put me to bed. She sat on the side of the bed in the dark and, in a whisper, taught me the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Matthew 6:11-12. That's all I remember of that visit to see my grandmother. In an unusual twist of fate, she died on my mother's birthday, February 15th. After that, oddly enough, my mother pretty much sainted her. As an adult, my mother was never a practicing Catholic, but for many years, she went to light a candle for her mother on that date. Strange how death can make people forgive those who trespassed against them and their children. For most of my early childhood, it was just my mother and me. We moved constantly. After an exhaustive search, she found us a place by the water. She wanted to be in a more peaceful setting where she could take long walks with the dog and go down the road to the beach. The two of us moved into what she referred to as a quaint cottage, but I later learned that the entire neighborhood called it the shack. I found the neighbor's description to be more accurate. It was a small, rickety structure covered in a wavy, faux brick siding that had buckled under the elements. Inside, a layer of dank sadness seeped through the floorboards and walls, which were covered with cheap imitation of wood paneling that was paired with filthy, flea-ridden carpeting. No matter the time of day, it was always dark inside. Prior to us moving in, the place had been abandoned and had become a hangout where teenagers would smoke, drink, and mess around. It was set off of a rough, unpaved driveway of rubble and stones and faced a big white Victorian house, which made it look like something the big house had belched out. It was marked, and so were we. My mother and I were the eccentric lady and her little girl who lived in the shack. How quaint. The first chapter of Marilyn Monroe's autobiography, My Story, is entitled How I Rescued a White Piano. In it, she writes about her mission to find her mother's 1937 baby grand piano. Gladys Monroe Baker, mother to Marilyn Monroe, born Norma Jean Mortensen, was in and out of psychiatric institutions all of her life. It's been documented that she suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, an incurable disease that performs a violent dance with the mind, releasing it to lucidity for brief moments, then, without warning, spinning it back into hellish delusion. As a result of her mother's inability to maintain sanity, Marilyn spent most of her childhood in orphanages, followed by a series of foster homes. During one of Gladys's rare healthy periods, she and little Norma Jean lived together for a few months in a small white house near the Hollywood Bowl. The most prized possession in their modest abode was a baby grand piano. When her mother's illness reared its ugly head again, dragging her back into darkness and into another institution, the few furnishings and the piano were sold off. After Norma Jean's transformation into Marilyn Monroe, the movie star, she spoke very little of her childhood, her mentally ill mother, or her unknown father. And though Marilyn had made herself into a radiant icon, I imagine there was a piece of her still searching for an uninterrupted childhood, longing for her mother to be whole. I see how the piano must have been a symbol of a time when she and her mother were together in relative peace and harmony. Pianos are elegant, mystical, and comforting. From them, simple tunes and majestic compositions can spring forth and fill a dismal living room, a dank bar, a concert hall, or even a shack with joy and glory. Marilyn went on a mission to find her mother's piano. As the story goes, while still a struggling model and actress, she found and purchased the piano at an auction and kept it in storage until she was able to move it into a home of her own. It accompanied her to all her residences. One of its final homes was the lavish Manhattan apartment Marilyn shared with her third and last husband, renowned playwright Arthur Miller, where she custom-coated the instrument in a thick, shiny white lacquer to match the apartment's glamorous angelic decor, a world of white, as her half-sister Bernice Miracle called it. "My happiest hours as a little girl were around that piano," Marilyn said. "I imagine when your childhood was fraught with insecurity and fear like Marilyn's and like mine, the romance of those lost happy hours is extremely valuable. I understood why she searched for, bought, stored, and cared for the piano, so much so that I rescued it at auction at Christie's in 1999. It is a treasure and my most expensive piece of art. And now, Marilyn Monroe's white baby grand piano is the centerpiece, the piece de resistance, of my own glamorous Manhattan penthouse. Marilyn was my first vision of a superstar that I could relate to on an almost spiritual level. We did without a lot of things when I was young, but what my mother couldn't live without was a piano. We always had a piano, and I had many happy and formative hours around it with my mother. My mother would go through songs and scales with me, and of course, I would hear her practicing her dramatic operatic scales. It was at the piano where I would sit and make up little tunes of my own. My mother never had much money, but one of her greatest contributions to my development was exposing me to all kinds of people, especially musicians. She made a few dollars here and there by giving voice lessons at our house. Her practicing was a constant, but what I treasured most were the jam sessions. Accomplished musicians would come and hang out and play music at my mother's bohemian spot by the bay, and I would jam with them. Live music was the best thing about living with my mother. I was surrounded by the love of music, but even more importantly, by the love of musicianship, the love of the craft, the love of the process. When I was a little girl, my mother introduced me to the world of sitting in with musicians, improvising, vibing, and singing. I particularly remember her singing from a Carly Simon songbook. She would play from it all the time. If I asked her to play a song for me to sing, she'd happily oblige. She never pushed me to sing or practice, but she encouraged me. She knew early on I had her advanced ear for music. When I was 5, she arranged for me to have piano lessons for a short time. But rather than read the music, I would play "Mary Had a Little Lamb" by ear. "Don't use your ear, don't use your ear," my teacher would implore. But I didn't know how not to use my ear, because music was a gift of freedom in my world of scarcity, the one place I felt unrestrained. I resisted the repetition and discipline required to learn how to read music and play the piano. Hearing and mimicking came so easily to me. This is one of several times I wished my mother had pushed me and made me sit and stick with it. My mother and her guitarist friend would also sing standards from the 1940s. Of course, that's the era I loved, not only for the glamour, but because the melodies were so strong. She particularly loved Billie Holiday and would often sing her songs. I remember hearing my mother sing, "I Can't Give You Anything But Love." I learned it, and we would sing it together, and I would instinctively scat, which I loved. It felt like my little girl version of catching the Holy Spirit. I learned several jazz standards from my mom and her musician pals, and some of them took note of my ear and natural abilities. At about 12 years old, I would sit with her and Clint, a piano player. He was a big brown teddy bear, and he could play his ass off. He would sit and work with me and treat me like a serious musician. When I would sit with him and sing, we were just two musicians working together. He taught me jazz classics, and one of the first songs I remember learning was Lullaby of Birdland, made famous by the great Ella Fitzgerald. I will always have a profound respect for Ms. Fitzgerald and all the jazz legends who laid such a fertile musical foundation for musicians of all genres. It was not an easy song at any age, but for me at 12, it was beyond advanced. With its intricate melody full of vocal shifts and changes, it was composed for one of the most nimble jazz vocalists of all time. Learning and listening to live jazz helped train my ear and shape my creative wiring. I was learning how to feel when to modulate and when to scat. Being introduced to jazz standards and a jazz discipline gave me my appreciation for sophisticated modulations in a song and how to employ them to communicate emotion. Stevie Wonder is the absolute master of this. For me, songs are always about emotion. My mother may not have taken me to church, but jamming with jazz musicians was close to a spiritual experience. There's a creative energy that flows through the room. You learn to sit and listen to what the other musicians are doing, and you get inspired by a guitar riff or what the pianist is playing. When you are in a zone, it is a miraculous madness. For me, it was always an exquisite escape, which I desperately needed and always sought. By the time I was 11 or 12, my mother was taking me to a supper club on Long Island to sit in with her and other musicians. There was a dining room on the ground floor where they would serve dinner, and upstairs was live jazz. I was in the sixth grade, up in there all hours of the night, any day of the week, sitting in with grown-ass musicians. I'm not sure if my mother just wanted to be able to hang out at night and sing and not be stuck in the shack, I mean cottage, with the kid, or if she was consciously developing me as an artist, or if maybe she wanted to present to her friends her little protege. I do remember her encouraging me while I sang. I felt more welcomed and natural with jazz musicians at night in the club than with my classmates during the day. Those kids who asked incessantly, "What are you?" Those kids who judged me by the way I looked and had no idea what my life was really like. I always knew that the world of suburban Long Island wasn't for me. I was a fish out of water, and though I survived it, I knew that no one there really cared about me, and I certainly knew I wasn't staying. And my mother wasn't just any old mom supporting me. She was a Juilliard-trained musician. Music was something we genuinely connected on, and without pushing or becoming one of those overbearing stage mothers or momagers, she instilled in me the power of believing in myself. Whenever I mused about what I'd do if I make it, she'd cut me short and say, "Don't say if I make it, say when I make it. Believe you can do it and you will do it." The fact that I believed I could become a successful artist is one of my greatest strengths. Around the same time, my mother entered me in a talent competition in the city, and I sang one of my favorite songs, "Out Here on My Own" by Irene Cara. I felt "Out Here on My Own" described my entire life, and I loved singing it that way, singing to reveal a piece of my soul. And I won doing it. At that age, I lived for the movie fame, and Irene Cara was everything to me. I related to her multicultural look, Puerto Rican and Cuban, her multi-textured hair, and, most importantly, her ambition and accomplishments. She won an Oscar for Best Original Song for "Flashdance, What a Feeling," which she co-wrote from "Flashdance," making her the first Black woman to win in a category other than acting. She won a Grammy, a Golden Globe, and an American Music Award for the song, too. But "Out Here on My Own" was such a pure song that touched my heart, and I couldn't believe I won a trophy for singing a song I loved. It was the first time I'd received validation as an artist. What a feeling. It wasn't just music my mother exposed me to. She had friends who treated me like family, which helped offset all the shabby places we lived and the disheveled way I often looked. My mother had a friend named Sunshine who was short and quite a large woman with a warm and generous heart. She wore her hair in two long ponytails like Carol and Paula from The Magic Garden, a popular local kids' TV show I loved, which was hosted by two young hippie-esque women with a pink squirrel sidekick who sang folksy songs and told stories in the 70s and early 80s. Sunshine had big older sons and no daughters, so she took an interest in me, especially in my disorderly and neglected appearance. She would often bring me cute, girly clothes that she made herself. On my sixth birthday, she outfitted me in a white embroidered shirt paired with a blue skirt, white tights, and Mary Jane shoes. She even got my hair to lie down in pigtails. Maybe being a Jewish woman and having textured hair gave her some insight. My birthday crown sat nicely right on top. She even bought me a birthday cake decorated like a lamb. A lamb! It is one of the few times I remember feeling beautiful as a child. Sunshine lovingly made sure I looked put together and cute. She was never anything but caring and sweet to me. Years later, when I was going into junior high, she came by with some clothes for me that I felt were too childish. I rejected them rudely in the cruel fashion of an angsty preteen. To this day, I regret how mean I was to such a considerate caretaker, one of the few in my whole life. I tried my hardest to accept all my mother's unfortunate choices in men. I even tried to impress them. Some of the names have been changed to protect the dickheads. Tales of a certain man in my mother's life right before my father loomed large in our household. We knew his name, Francois. We knew he was Lebanese, and we knew he was rich. Despite her great talents, my mother, like many women of her era, subscribed to the belief that a man was her most reliable source of security. The time between the relationships she had with Francois and with my father was not long. It was even sometimes suggested there had been some overlap, which led to the suspicion that perhaps Morgan was not my father's child. Drama. After the divorce from my father, my mother and Francois reconnected, and she planned an epic reunion with the rich man who got away. My mother got Morgan and me excited about the fantasy that a wealthy, exotic man would come and sweep us up out of our rundown digs and we would be set for life. All we had to do was impress him. I could do that, I thought. Maybe my mother and I could sing a song at the piano. The night of their big date arrived, and while my mother and Francois were out, I pulled together the best little outfit I could to greet him. I was nervous because my mother wanted to be rescued bad, and I wanted to be in a nice, safe place too. The stakes were high. I was home alone when my mother and Francois returned. I was home alone a lot as a child. Determined to do my part to make this relationship work for my mother, I ran to the door. Francois came in ahead of her. He was a tall, imposing older man in a dark suit with sharp, mysterious features. "Hello," I began cheerily, perhaps throwing in a curtsy for dramatic effect. "Shut up," he barked. "Where is my son?" The force of his words crushed every bit of enthusiasm out of me. He was scary. I was only a kid, and this big stranger had stormed into my house, dismissed me, and screamed at me. I ran crying to my mother's bedroom. She tried to calm me down, but I was inconsolable. I'm not sure if Francois ever saw Morgan, who had our father's black features running all up and through him, but needless to say, no rich, heroic man saved us that day. No man saved us any day. I did not like or trust most of my mother's men. She had one older black boyfriend, Leroy, who tried to protect us from Morgan during one of his more violent episodes by saying, "I got my piece," and flashing a pistol. Imagine that, your mother's boyfriend carrying a gun and threatening to use it on her teenage son, your brother. Sadly, it did make me feel safer. Morgan had become a scary presence to me by then. However, my mother's men were not all bad. Nothing and no one is ever all bad. There was a sweet man in my mother's life named Henry. He was my favorite. He was about 10 years younger than my mother and a horticulturalist. He drove an old red pickup truck outfitted for the field. His many gardening tools, tree cuttings, mulch, and other supplies would stick out from the back. He knew his trade. He was very well educated and grew extraordinary plants that towered over me, mainly some species that were illegal at the time. He also grew an impressive afro that seemed to float around his head. My mother and I lived in a few different places with Henry, but for a while, the three of us were in a small house on a grand estate where he was the gardener. The place gave me plantation vibes, and we lived in the modern equivalent of the servants' quarters. But still, Henry's house was nicer than most of the houses we'd lived in and gave me a brief moment of stability. I was in the third grade when we lived there, and Henry built me a swing on a big old tree that was near what looked to me like a mini mountain made of garbage. One day, he brought home two rescue kittens, one for me and one for him. I liked his better. He was orange with a very special spirit. Ultimately, he became mine. He grew to be big and squishy, and his name was Morris, like the icon. I'd sit and swing with him on my lap. We truly loved each other. I confided in him when I had a really hard day at school, which was often. I never fit in with the kids, who were all white, and most of whom lived in estates in that neighborhood. I was the child of the girlfriend of the hired help, and they let me know it. I brought my troubles to Morris. Even if I had had any friends, I wouldn't have wanted them to see I lived near a trash dump. Once, when I was really upset, after having a pretty big argument with my mother, I ran out of the house, grabbed my cat, and headed for my place. While swinging over the hill of garbage, with Morris in my lap, the smell of rotting food wafting over my face, I promised myself no matter what, I would never forget what it felt like to be a child. A moment I recreated years later in the Vision of Love video, sans the garbage. I wanted to be sentimental, not bleak. I really liked Henry. He was an Aries, just like me. We would dance, and he would pick me up and twirl me around. He provided me with glimpses of what the life of a carefree little girl could be. Henry was kind, and he paid for my second year of performing arts summer camp. I remember his mother, who used to work for Estee Lauder and was an exceptional cook. One day, she laid out a divine soul food spread ending with a German chocolate cake, which I had never had before. It was a delicious, warm, gooey, homemade pile of happiness. But with all that love also came darkness. Henry was a Black Vietnam veteran and was severely damaged by the consequences of both of those identities. I suspect he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and even as a kid, I was aware of his occasional psychedelic drug usage. I believe the fallout from his experiences of war and racism was the root cause of why he and my mother broke up. One day, near the end of my third grade school year, I got home and my mother was up in arms. She announced, "We can't stay here anymore. We have to leave now." She already had our things packed and in the car. Henry was sitting in a chair in the middle of the kitchen. The lights were off, and I could see the strong silhouette of his afro. He was holding a long double-barreled shotgun in one of his hands. Staring down at the white linoleum floor, he said very calmly, "You're not leaving me. I'm not going to let you guys leave." He never raised his head or voice and seemed to be in kind of a trance-like state. "I'm not going to let you guys go," he said. "I'm going to chop you up and put you in the refrigerator and make you guys stay here." Well, after he said that, I rushed to get into the car. My mother started the engine. "Morris," I screamed. "I have to get Morris. He's still in there." Panicked, I jumped out of the car. I was determined to get my cat. That cat represented too much for me. He was unconditional love to me. "Be careful," my mother said as she let me re-enter a house occupied by an armed man who just threatened to chop us up. Henry never did anything to hurt me, and perhaps she believed he wouldn't now, but still. I had to pass the kitchen with Henry and the shotgun to search the other rooms for Morris. When I finally found him, I scooped him up in my arms and ran out of the house and jumped in the car. As we sped off, my heart was going a mile a minute. "Hallelujah, I got Morris," I triumphantly exclaimed. I never knew what happened between her and Henry, and I never saw him after that day. I heard that many years later, while he was riding down the road in his same vintage red pickup, "Vision of Love" by Mariah Carey came bursting through his old radio. I was told that he rolled down the window and yelled out into the fresh air, "She made it, she made it." I really hope Henry made it too. My mother did occasionally try to give us moments. She would save up a little money so we could do things like go to dinner in New York City. And it was on these excursions that I developed a taste for the finer things. I have a distinct memory of one night when we were riding back from the city. I was looking out the back window at the New York City skyline, and I said to myself, "This is where I'm going to live when I grow up. I want to have this view." I always knew we lived in shitty places, among other people's nice houses in the suburbs. I never dreamed I'd get married and live in a big white Victorian house or even a cozy little home like my gunkles, but I did envision something grand. I remember watching Mommy Dearest and seeing Joan Crawford's pristine manor. "That's what I want," I thought. I even believed I could surpass its splendor. Even then, I saw myself living in a mansion or more because I knew I would realize my dreams. And when I saw the New York skyline looking like a giant silver crystal encrusted with multicolored jewels, I envisioned I would live somewhere where I could see that. And I do. I see it clearly. I see the entire city from the rooftop of my downtown Manhattan penthouse. As a result of a lot of hard labor, I went from swinging over garbage to singing in a mansion in the sky. So yes, my mother exposing me to beauty and culture gave me encouragement and lifelong lessons that contributed both to my art and to what is good in me. But my mother also created persistent turmoil, which caused trauma and deep sadness. It has taken me a lifetime to find the courage to confront the stark duality of my mother, the beauty and the beast that coexist in one person, and to discover there's beauty in all of us, but who loved you and how they loved you will determine how long it takes to realize it. Looking back now, I can see that in my early years, there was significant neglect. For one, there were the people my mother let be around me, particularly my violent brother, my troubled sister, and their sketchy cohorts. And I often looked a mess, though I believe that was likely a result of my mother being oblivious, in the name of being bohemian, rather than malicious. However, I noticed a shift in our relationship when I was about 14 years old. One night, as we were riding together in the Dodge Dent, as she called it, Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell came on the radio. It was a huge international hit on Motown Records at the time, and I loved it, largely because Michael Jackson sang the hook. We were driving and bopping along with the song when my mother broke out into Michael's signature part of the chorus.
I always feel like somebody's watching me.
She sang it in an elaborate operatic style, and I turned my face to the window to hide my giggle. I mean, it's a very 80s R&B record with the hook sung in Michael Jackson's impeccably smooth signature style, so to hear it delivered like Beverly Sills, a popular Brooklyn-born operatic soprano from the 1950s to the 1970s, was pretty hilarious to my teenage singer's ears. Oh, but Mother was not amused. She whipped the volume knob down and glared at me, her brownish-green eyes narrowing and hardening to stone. What's so funny? She spat. Her seriousness quickly swallowed up the silliness of the moment. I stuttered, well, that's just not how it goes. She stared at me until every bit of lightness faded. Almost growling, she said, you should only hope that one day you become half the singer I am. My heart dropped. Still, to this day, what she said haunts and hurts me. I don't know if she meant to cut me down to size or if it was just her bruised ego talking. All I know is that those words that shot out of her mouth pierced my chest and were buried in my heart. These words were there in my heart in 1999 when I was acknowledged and respected for my voice and my compositions by two of the greatest opera talents of all time. I was invited to join Luciano Pavarotti in Pavarotti and Friends, a prestigious annual fundraising concert for children in war-torn countries, hosted by the great tenor, the maestro, in his hometown of Modena, Italy. The concert was directed for TV by Spike Lee, you dig? It's an ancient town known for producing fancy sports cars like Ferraris and Lamborghinis, as well as balsamic vinegar. And I'm sure whatever indulgences the maestro desired were imported. I brought my mother and my wonderful little nephew, Mike, with me. I was proud and happy to be able to treat her to a glamorous trip and to introduce her to one of her idols. In a strapless, pale pink silk taffeta sheath gown, my mother watched me share a grand outdoor stage in front of 50,000 people with one of the greatest and most famous opera singers of all time. Not only did we sing together, he sang my song. Pavarotti sang an Italian version of Hero with me for the whole world to see, for my mother to see. Then, in May 2005, I met the phenomenal soprano Leontine Price, the first Black woman to become a prima donna at the Metropolitan Opera and the most awarded classical singer, when she was being honored at Oprah's illustrious Legends Ball, which celebrated 25 African-American women in art, entertainment, and civil rights. The historic weekend began on Friday with a private luncheon at her Montecito home, where the legends were greeted by the youngins, including Alicia Keys, Angela Bassett, Halle Berry, Mary J. Blige, Naomi Campbell, Missy Elliott, Tyra Banks, Iman, Janet Jackson, Felicia Rashad, Debbie Allen, myself, and many more. And throughout the extraordinary weekend, we youngins paid homage to the legends for their great contributions. My mother would often boast, oh yes, Leontine and I had the same vocal coach. And here I was hanging out with her at Oprah Winfrey's house, no less. Madame Price remembered my mother, and she also validated my talent. On the day after Christmas that year, on the most elegant, thick, eggshell-colored stationery, I received a letter from her. In the difficult, demanding business of performing arts, you are the crown jewel of success. To achieve your level of success as a multidimensional artist is an outstanding measure of your artistic talent, it went on to say. It was a pleasure to visit with you during the Legends Weekend and to tell you in person how much I admire you and your artistry. Your creativity and performances are superb. You present your compositions with a depth of feeling that is rarely, if ever, seen or heard. It is a joy to watch you turn all of the obstacles you faced into stepping stones to success. Your devotion to your art and career are praiseworthy. This brings you a standing ovation and a resounding brava, 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 debt. I guess to my mother, I may not have been half the singer she was, but I was the whole singer and artist I was. This was my first glimpse into how misguided words from a mother can really affect a child. What a simple difference a laugh along from her would have made. Whatever had connected us before, a fragile mother-daughter bond, was shattered in that moment. There was a distinct shift. She made me feel like the competition, like a threat. In place of our previous bond grew a different tie, a rope tethering us through shared biology and social obligation. In no way did my mother crush my dreams of being successful that day. My faith had grown too strong by then. Having people you love be jealous of you professionally comes with the territory of success, but when the person is your mother and the jealousy is revealed at such a tender age, it's particularly painful. I was going through some heavy shit then, and for her to expose her insecurity to me in that way at that time was damaging. I'd already had so many years of insecurity around my physical safety. Though a subtle, brief moment, this was the first blow in a